mendelspark.com.
Sharon Begley is here. She's the senior science writer for Stat News, covering genetics, cancer, neuroscience, and other fields of biomedical research. Prior to writing for Stat, Sharon was the senior health and science correspondent at Reuters, the science columnist at the Wall Street Journal, and science editor at Newsweek. She joins us for the first time. For our last show of the year, we want to take a moment and thank all of this year's underwriters. We're completing our sixth year at Mendelspod, where we've become a primary source for that inside scoop on anything genomics. It wouldn't be possible without you, our sponsors. Thank you. Welcome to Mendelspod.
Thank you for having me.
So you're our special end-of-the-year guest this year for looking back over 2017 and coming up with, well, for shooting the breeze. No, it's our chance to really just look at the trends and what a year you've had. You are so prolific. Just, you know, reviewing the width and the breadth and not just the amount, but the, you know, the depth and the quality of your output. Wow.
Just, well, thank you. It, of course, helps when there's a lot of, what should we say, raw material out there, as long as the scientists keep coming up with amazing advances. There's just a lot to write about.
Yeah, in our field, you don't have to rely on Russia for fake news. So this is your second year at Stat. You were there when they started. Now, coming from Newsweek, Wall Street Journal, Reuters, was that a shift in audience for you? Like, who do you write for at Stat?
A little bit, right. So Stat is the brainchild of the owner of the Boston Globe. His name is John Henry. He is actually better known, at least around these parts, for also owning the Boston Red Sox. And he looked around a couple, 3 years ago and noticed how much biotech, biomedical research, life sciences research, and of course clinical care there is in the Boston-Cambridge area, and decided that it needed an entirely new standalone publication to do it justice, and he therefore decided to launch Stat. So it is different from the other places that I worked, which, of course, catered to a general audience, an educated, interested, curious audience, but one that had a great breadth of interests. And here at Stat, we hope that we are writing stories for people who are, just ordinary human beings, people who go to doctors, people whose friends and loved ones get sick, etc. But we also write for people who have a specific special interest in the fields that we cover, which I would characterize as broadly the life sciences. So we really do dig down into the basic biomedical research. We also cover pharma and biotech. We have part of the site that's behind a paywall that was launched about a year ago for people whose business really is in these areas. So it's been a great experience so far. We seem to be successful. And the only other thing I'd add in terms of difference from where I've worked previously, Stat is, of course, an online-only publication, especially optimized for mobile. And as such, the multimedia component of what we do is just as important as the plain old words. So it's been great to partner with people here who do video and data visualization and all these other elements that can really add so much to a story.
Yeah, and I've gotten from your pieces that you've struck that balance with talking to, a lay audience. I mean, I feel like all your articles could be read by anyone. But also, like, you're sharing some insider secrets, like you have access to that insider stuff.
Well, I hope so. And the idea is that all of the stories can be read and understood by anyone who's interested. The only difference, I would say, is that for some stories, especially those that are really, really in the weeds, there are simply fewer people who are interested. But yes, we hope that, just regular, curious, interested readers dip into our stories and, learn a little bit more about what's going on, both in terms of the research that might have an impact on their lives, down the road, but also stuff that's happening today. Very sort of user-friendly, consumer-relevant stories, you know, ranging from the latest advances in treatments of glioblastoma to, you know, neuroscience, genetics, et cetera. We're certainly still feeling our way. We are, again, just a couple of years old. But we hope that we're, you know, hitting the sweet spot more often than we're missing.
Let's jump into some of those topics and stories. Where do you want to start, CRISPR or President Trump's mental health? because those were the two topics that were sort of competing for the most written about on your list. You had like a dozen articles about.
Yes, I did a lot on both. You know, why don't we start with CRISPR, just because this was the year that an American lab CRISPR'd babies, you know, to put it in tabloid terms. This was work out of Oregon Health and Sciences University, where researchers used CRISPR, which is, of course, the genome editing technology, to alter the DNA of just over 100 viable human embryos, you know, very, very early stage, and the embryos did not go on to develop, let alone get, you know, implanted into a surrogate mother. But it really was a demonstration that what people had either warned about or promised would happen from, gosh, 3 years ago when CRISPR first really burst on the scene, that it would one day be used to alter the genetic legacy of human beings. Now, obviously, that didn't happen fully in this case. Again, very just days-old human embryos, they did not develop. But it was, if nothing else, a proof of principle that this was very, very likely to be at least technologically possible. And, you know, we're going to go from there.
Yeah. And it happened, as you say, in Oregon, in the United States, because, you know, exactly. For a couple of years we've been saying, oh, yeah, it's in China. But, you know, there was sort of a self-imposed moratorium in the U.S.
Yes. And of course, it has been happening in China. Just a few months after the Oregon work, the team that really shook things up, gosh, I think that was early 2015, when they said that they had used CRISPR to edit non-viable human embryos. They did basically the same thing, this time in viable human embryos. So again, very much like the Oregon work, which, you know, Theral just points out that once a scientific technique is out there and published in the open literature, you know, labs throughout the world are going to be using it for good or ill, trying to stay as much as they can within the legal and ethical confines of the, you know, society where they work, but, you know, also definitely pushing the limits, I would say.
So I look back, and I knew I had read articles about Trump's mental health, but I didn't realize till I was preparing for this interview that you had written them all.
Well, as I say, for good or ill, right?
This yes, was your way of pushing back.
Would you like to know how it happened?
Sure.
Well, no, you know, seriously. Donald Trump was, of course, elected. And between Election Day and Inauguration Day, he started saying and doing some noteworthy things, not so much in terms of appointments or policy announcements or things like that, but more personal things, especially on Twitter, as all of your listeners are undoubtedly aware. And my editor asked what sounded like a perfectly innocent, you know, question, which was, do you think you could get together a bunch of psychiatrists and have them serve as our in-house panel on whether Donald Trump has a mental illness? And I heard that, and I thought about it, and I said, huh, that's an interesting idea. So, you know, an editor asks something and the reporter dutifully scurries around and tries to fulfill the request. It will probably not shock you to hear that there was not a line of psychiatrists outside our door volunteering to do this.
Right. There was that issue where they had a sort of agreement among psychiatrists.
Right. And just, you know, slight quick detour. That's because something called the Goldwater Rule, which dates back to the 70s, prohibits, this is from the American Psychiatric Association, and it prohibits psychiatrists from offering their opinion, their insights into the mental health, or specifically any mental illness, in a public figure unless the psychiatrist has treated the public figure, in which case, of course, they're not going to talk because then that's doctor-patient confidentiality. But the point was, you cannot just observe someone's public behavior, listen to his or her public speeches, and then reach any kind of conclusion or even offer even tentative hypotheses about what's going on in the person's head. So the Goldwater Rule really has acted like a gag order on psychiatrists. Fortunately for, you know, ink-stained wretches like myself, it does not really specifically apply to psychologists, different field, right? And there are still some psychiatrists who, even though they are supposedly bound by it, are so opposed to it, again, because they feel it's a gag order, that they are willing to flout it. So, as I say, we were not able to assemble the in-house panel of psychiatrists, but fortunately, I was able to reach quite a number, both for the first story that you're referring to, which appeared around Trump's inauguration, and then for subsequent ones, because we have dipped in from time to time when he has done something, again, that sort of got the Twitterati and the, you know, the pundits talking, to ask, is there anything that might be interesting to say about what this behavior reflects in terms of his thinking, his emotions, his psychology, his mind, all of those things. So, yeah, it's been a interesting exercise.
I was fascinated. I think I read all of them as they came out. I mean, I knew you specialized in covering neuroscience, you know, I mean, so you were the one to listen to there. Actually, the timing was very interesting here because, you know, President Obama began the Brain Initiative, and then the next president needed it.
Yes, and of course, Obama's Brain Initiative does promise to reveal all sorts of insights into how we think and feel and remember and do all of those things. So maybe by the time it has some results for us, which is still a number of years away, we will know all about what is going on inside the head of the current president.
Okay, so I led you down these two paths. What stands out for you this year?
I'm going to go back to genetic and genomic technology, and that's because we really did have a number of breakthroughs this year. Let me just mention a couple of them. One is that just a couple months ago, October, a panel of outside experts unanimously recommended that the FDA approve what would be the first form of true gene therapy. And by true gene therapy, I mean you take a virus, you load it up with a healthy gene, you put it into people who have a mutated disease-causing version of that gene, and lo and behold, they are fixed. So in this case, the disease is a hereditary form of blindness. The drug, the gene therapy, is called Luxturna. It's made by Spark Therapeutics, and it would be, again, inside a virus. And what was so groundbreaking about the research that Spark submitted to the FDA, which led to this recommendation for approval, is that they got the gene into enough of the cells of the individuals who were in the clinical trial that their blindness did in fact go away. Now, always an asterisk with gene therapy. The FDA will make a final decision, a yes or no decision, next month, we're told, by January 12th. And it's not completely clear yet how long the virus, which again is carrying the healthy gene, how long it will last. And the reason that's important, obviously, is not only because we hope that people who are treated will stay treated, that their blindness will not somehow return, but because, surprise, surprise, gene therapies are going to cost an incredible amount of money. I mean, easily into the mid six figures. So if you are spending $500,000 and north for something like that, you really, payers, by which we mean private insurers, but also Medicare, Medicaid, are really going to demand, this is a cure. This is not just making somebody a little bit better for a short amount of time. So that really will be something to watch in 2018.
Yeah, that's the challenge here, is going to be the price. But they are incredible breakthroughs, and we've had a few this year. I mean, we've had some, you know, we used to hear, okay, the genome was sequenced, you know, over a decade ago. Where are the therapies? Where's the delivery on this? And we're seeing some.
We're definitely getting close. You know, so that was something that's through its human trials before the FDA. We'll see what happens. Stuff that's just in the pipeline, the research pipeline, is also, and I should pause here and say that I have long been one of the skeptics of gene therapy, probably because I was too influenced by the failures in the, basically the 1990s, right?
Yeah.
Which culminated in
the
tragic death. Yes, of a young man. And I don't know if you remember, too, that was 1999, so 18 years ago. It feels like yesterday. Anyway, after that, gene therapy really was off the table. It was regarded as too dangerous because the gene that you were putting in some cases, inserted itself in the double helix in the quote-unquote wrong place and caused all sorts of problems, or the viruses that you were using for a delivery vehicle, they caused, you know, inflammation or some other horrible side effect. So this is a therapy or a potential therapy that was just dormant for close to 20 years. So let me just mention another one. So there's this horrible disease called spinal muscular atrophy, SMA. Again, it's inherited, and the babies who are born with it almost always die before the age of two. And in a very, you know, prominent clinical trial, again reported this year, I think it was just November, actually, last month, a gene therapy for it seems to have worked. And what's so notable about that is not only the it worked part, but the fact that because this has to do with the spinal system, it's a central nervous system disorder, this virus carried the healthy gene, the therapeutic gene, into the central nervous system, into the brain, across the blood-brain barrier. And before, any time that you wanted to treat a neurological disease with gene therapy, they literally were drilling holes in people's skulls. So, you know, we always talk about, as you just said, the human gene project and sequencing the genome, et cetera. But just as important to making this work are the viruses. So
the delivery.
Anyway, found a virus. Yes, these researchers found a virus. It crosses the blood-brain barrier. You just have to infuse this stuff into a vein, and it goes into the children's brain and seems to, again, fix them. These kids who are usually dead, you know, within just a few months are now alive and in at least a few cases walking. So again, it's not unfortunately a disease that is very common, although I suppose we should be grateful for that because it's so awful. But it does, again, serve as a proof of principle that, I mean, could this approach be used for something that is common, you know, Parkinson's disease or something, where you would have to get the therapy into the brain. So now we have the delivery vehicle, which opens just all sorts of new possible avenues.
One of your articles that stands out for me, you know, we've both interviewed George Church. And this year, and I read your article about him just before I did my interview, and it was delightful, I have to say. I mean, let me read the title. A feature, not a bug, George Church ascribes his visionary ideas to narcolepsy. Boom, what a headline. Do you write your headlines?
I usually suggest one, and then greater minds than mine try to make them better.
You get some help. Okay, nice. But boom, I mean, for a guy who's been interviewed how many times, right? You went in, you found an interesting angle. I mean, I'd heard of the narcolepsy stuff, but not to this extent. It was fascinating. Kudos, really.
Well, thank you. So as you say, if you look for George Church interviews, profiles, et cetera, there will often be a sentence saying, oh, and he has narcolepsy. And he happened to mention it again at a private dinner party. And I therefore approached him and said, might you be willing to talk about this at some length? which is always a tricky ask. You probably have found this as well, getting somebody who's already in the public eye to open up about something as personal as, you know, an illness that he has had for, in this case, decades.
Okay, so reason, you actually started with this in mind then? That you had this idea of the article before you...
It was not like I was talking to him. No, I was not talking to him about some basic science thing, and he happened to say, oh, let me tell you about my narcolepsy.
Uh-huh.
No, this was a specific ask. And the reason he agreed is sort of as you just said in quoting the headline. Church believes, first of all, that no illness should be the source of shame. A neurological one,
beautiful,
not a mental
thought.
One, not anything that just strikes below the neck, right? But also, he... In the, again, the decades since he has had this, and he traces it back to his childhood, not surprisingly, he has found that it can be a feature, not a bug. So what does he mean by that? Because the headline really was just snatching his own words. He told me that when he drifts off, which he will do really at the slightest provocation, or maybe we should say non-provocation, like sitting on a panel, certainly sitting in the audience of the meeting,
like
sitting with friends, whatever. Yeah, no, it just happens all the time. But he said that both, and he's not out for long, like just a few minutes.
Oh, I know, yeah. I've seen it.
Yeah, but either usually when he's coming out of it, something about the brain state, the mental state, that is characteristic of the, you know, sleeping form, the sleeping part of narcolepsy, enables him to sort of free associate almost in a pre-dream state, or the kind of mental state you're in when you're just coming out of a dream. It's not really clear. He's not in REM sleep for the most part. He's usually not paralyzed, although that can vary. But he just believes that it has enabled him to make some of the creative conceptual leaps that he is known for. And just to, you know, tick them off quickly for your listeners, I mean, Church has contributed to the sequencing of the human genome. He is a leader in synthetic biology. He has the idea of writing the human genome, not just reading it. He is making brain organoids, little teeny globs of brain, sort of mini brains, that might show us all sorts of things, including how, you know, schizophrenia, Alzheimer's, all these other devastating diseases develop. Anyway, so he really has his fingers in a lot of pies, and
yeah,
I haven't
even our audience is pretty
the woolly mammoth, right?
I mean, yes. We've had him on four or five times.
He believes that he has, yes, and he believes that he has these flights of fancy in part, that he sees things that other people do not because of the mental state he's in, thanks to his narcolepsy. So he turned out to be quite willing to talk about it. I think I had only half an hour or so with him. And I got a lot of nice feedback from that, including from people who have narcolepsy themselves. They felt that it was, you know, if not empowering, then at least reassuring. And it's always nice when you can do a story that has that effect.
Yeah, a nice kind of coming out in a way. That's so nice for other people, who have it. So we're a podcast devoted to genomics. And people certainly know him. And genomics is really our thing. And so you have a wider swath than we do. But you get into some geeky stuff, which you mentioned in the beginning, into the weeds. And one headline you referenced, long read sequencing, how it was used to diagnose a new disease. And in fact, there's been, you know, many new applications for long reads over the past couple of years. I'm curious, how much has long read sequencing showed up on your radar?
Only a little bit. And the reason that came up at all was coincidentally because of something Church told me when we were, gosh, I think I was moderating a panel that he served on or something, and he just happened to toss out, you know, the human genome was never actually fully sequenced. And I said, huh? And he said, yeah, really? And I said, okay, can I call you about that? So he then expanded on that there are regions of the human genome that are simply not accessible to the form of sequencing that was used in the Human Genome Project, that is still used in almost all the sequencing devices, mostly Illumina's, today, which is there's shotgun sequencing and a few others. But I think if many people, not your audience, but many people just reading the phrase think that somehow the machines are reading one nucleotide after the other from, you know, the beginning,
from beginning to end. Yes.
Yeah. So that's not happening.
Right.
But one way to bridge the data gaps is through, again, long read sequencing. So I did one story saying, hey, guess what? The human genome was never sequenced despite all the announcements. And gosh, what was it? 2003, I guess they started.
Right. That was another great headline, by the way. You had something like, psst, the genome isn't finished yet.
And so then I did a follow-up looking at PacBio and a couple of other companies that are indeed developing these long-read technologies, which at least have the potential to, as I say, bridge those gaps and finally complete this thing that, you know, most people think was completed a decade ago. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think, you know, yeah, our audience knows about it, but I think our audience is curious how much this kind of stuff is getting out there, you know, and so I think you're the person to ask. And to wrap things up, what I'm curious about is, because for me, I think the story of the year, I mean, we have to talk about Trump. And we have to talk about regulation, you know, because one day the FDA is going to regulate genetic testing and the next day they're not because of Trump. And we even have FDA regulators coming on the program saying what's going to happen. And the next day they're going into private companies, right? And so the big story, I think, this year has got to have been the boom in direct consumer testing. And I'm curious what you think. I mean, let's remember, 23andMe was tying with the Instapot on Amazon for top seller on Black Friday this year. And so I'm curious, what does the average person think of genomics in 2017?
Because 23andMe finally made nice with the FDA and got FDA approval to sell, to market genetic tests for, what is that, I think a dozen genetic inherited illnesses, that really put DTC genetic testing back on the radar screen. What the average person, the person who answers surveys, thinks about genetic testing, my sense, just reading the polls and talking to some of the people who have answered them, because STAT also has done some of these surveys, people are genetic determinists. They really, really believe that if you have a gene, quote unquote, for an illness, you are very likely to get that illness. Now, 23andMe, the other testing companies, hopefully your physician, if the physician is involved, you know, do their best to explain that, no, that is not the case.
But does that strike you as honestly, odd in an overwhelmingly religious country?
Not necessarily, because, you know, maybe God gave me that gene. I mean, that could be a mindset. God put that gene into me, and that's what's going to happen.
They could work together.
To explain the mindset of where religion intersects with genetics. But, you know, you can spin a story that explains anything. So whether it's getting your DNA tested to see what sport you should play, or frankly, what your children are most likely to excel at, there's recreational genetics, not just, you know, do I carry an allele that makes me more likely to develop Parkinson's disease, but do I have an allele that, you know, in maybe one study in 2011 of 17 people was associated with greater musical ability? Because that really is what some of the DTC companies, again, the less serious ones, so I'm not including 23andMe here, that's what they are selling. They are also selling what should you eat because of your, you know, genetic inheritance. So it really is going crazy. So some people are doing it just for fun. But I have to believe that, and again, surveys bear this out, people really believe that DNA is destiny.
Do you see your job as to come in and somewhat push against that?
I try, you know, for the 23andMe announcement, which also was this year. I did it as a Q&A, which is a format I'm becoming fonder and fonder of. And we included questions like, if I am told that I have the gene or a gene for, you know, fill in the blank, does that mean I'm going to get it? So that was an opportunity for me to explain about genetic background, interaction between different genes, the fact that many of the studies that have found an association between an allele and a phenotype and outcome were done on, you know, your basic white Europeans, and does it therefore apply to people of other ethnicities? So I really do view what we do here as an opportunity for informing people, for educating them, for maybe, you know, they come away from the story knowing a teeny bit more, or just being having their brain tickled so that they should ask a few more questions, maybe be a little bit less credulous than before they read the story. And honestly, that's all you can do.
Sharon Begley, Chief Science Writer at Stat News. This is so much fun. I could go on and on with you. So many places we didn't go. But what a joy. I'll look forward to all the articles next year. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the great questions. And I'm sure 2018 will be just as fun.
Again, at the end of the year, we want to thank all of our sponsors who have made the show possible and wish you all a happy holiday. Talk to you in the new year.